I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Lamont McIntyre went to prison in 1994 for a double murder he didn't commit. He remained there until his release exactly 1 week ago. Today, we meet the newly free man and his mom and the lawyer who helped get him exonerated. We'll find out the kind of work that goes into getting an innocent man out of prison and ask how this all happened in the first place. McIntyre says it was hope that kept him going in prison. We'll learn from his mother how family and friends kept faith in his innocence and how he hopes to move on from such a miscarriage of justice. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. One week ago today, Lamont McIntyre walked out of a Wyandotte County courtroom, not in handcuffs, not in a prison jumpsuit, not guilty. After going to prison for a double murder in 1994, prosecutors told the judge that they would no longer contest the evidence that he was wrongly convicted of those crimes, and McIntyre walked out into the arms of his mother and embraced 23 years in the making. Joining us this morning to talk about his story and his future is Lamont McIntyre, and his mom Rosie McIntyre is joining us here as well. Welcome to both of you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're really glad you're here. A lot of us have seen video of that moment last week when you walked out, Lamont, and had your first few minutes of freedom and gave your mom a big hug. What was that like for you?
Something I've been looking forward to for a long time. So it was like a dream come true for me.
And, had you envisioned that moment, or did it catch you by surprise?
I didn't know it would be that exciting, though, that, you know, that I didn't know what to expect, you know, truly, but I know it was great, and I looked forward to it, you know, for a long time.
It must have been pretty surreal for you as well, Rosie, to watch your son walking towards you, a free man.
Yes, it was. I mean, it was just joy.
Yeah, how did you think that day would ever come?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, I did.
Did you ever lose hope that that was going to happen?
No.
Really? I think a lot of people would be surprised by that.
No, I mean, I just never stopped fighting, so.
Yeah. Well, one of the people who helped you with that fight is Cheryl Pilot. She's one of the attorneys who brought this case to a conclusion. Cheryl, we're glad you're here as well.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you. So how long did you work on this case?
8 years.
I saw you counting in your head. How surprised were you by how things unfolded last Friday?
I always had faith and strong belief that that day would come. Sometimes the justice system is slow to correct the wrongs that occur, but I had faith that this wrong would be corrected. We had an overwhelming amount of evidence showing Lamont's innocence. It took us some time to develop that, but we had it. We were confident in it, and we felt like we were in a really good position, not only to prove his innocence, but how his trial was unfair and unconstitutional. But all that said, I have to say that the particular moment that everything came together and the district attorney made the decision that he did and Lamont was released, that moment was a surprise.
Because you'd expected a week-long hearing.
Absolutely. And at the moment all of that unfolded in the courtroom, I was sitting there with a pile of notes and outlines for the remaining witnesses for the afternoon. And it was just a very swift and changing of gears. Yeah. And I have to say, I think all of us were a bit startled and then overwhelmed with joy in that moment. It was something like I have never experienced before.
Well, just to review the story, two men, Donnell Quinn and Daniel Ewing, were shot and killed sitting in a car in KCK in 1994. And you, Lamont, were convicted in a four-day trial, even though police produced no motive, no murder weapon, no evidence that you knew either of the victims. There was testimony that you were with family all day when the murders occurred, but still you were convicted. Take us back, if you can. I know you were just 18 years old at the time of that trial, but what do you remember about that experience of being wrongly convicted, of hearing the word guilty when you knew you weren't?
I think for the most part I was shocked. At that time I did have faith in the justice system, and I knew that I had nothing to do with the crime, or I wasn't responsible for the death of those two men, so I kind of expected to walk out the courtroom that day. So when a guilty verdict, it came back with a guilty verdict, it kind of threw me off guard because I didn't expect that. Yeah. So I was kind of, from that moment, I was pretty much in shock.
Did that shock give way then to anger?
Yeah, it did. For the first 3-4 years of that experience, I was real angry and bitter, and I was just hurt. Because I knew that I wasn't responsible for the crime they had me convicted of, and I didn't have no help, you know. So mm-hmm. No many times I said I was innocent, no many times I reached out to someone saying they had the wrong person, no one listened, so that turned into anger and frustration. So, yeah, for the first part, it was rough.
You know, hearing you say that you didn't have any help, I look over at you, Rosie, and I have to think, you know, you must have thought, I'm his mother, I want to help him, but what could you do?
I tried everything I could help.
Yeah, what did you do in those early days? What was your what were your emotions that you were feeling?
Well, like my son said, it was like something you don't believe, because we was always willing to cooperate with authorities. I as well thought that I was getting my son back, but like he said, there was no help, and it went so quick, you didn't really have time to work anything out to try to help him, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lamont, where did you serve those 23 years?
Between two prisons, Hutchinson Correctional Facilities and Lansing Correctional Facilities.
And so sitting there in Hutchinson, in Lansing, you've talked a lot about feeling a sense of hope. Yeah. I think that's hard for a lot of people to get their head around, that you were able to feel something that could be called hope. Where was that coming from? Why were you hopeful?
Well, I always had a religious family, spiritual family. So my grandmother, I had grandparents who was raised in the church and raised me in the church. So I had a spiritual background, but I just didn't have faith in God at that time, because I was so hurt and so deep down in my depression in that moment, that my mother always encouraged me. My grandparents, my mother, they always encouraged me to keep going. So even when I didn't want her to come to visit me and be around me, because I was so angry and so hurt that this one thing is my life and I didn't want her to be a part of it, I used to press her away and ask her not to come. And she would always be there anyway. And she would tell me that we're going to fight this thing through and don't give up. She's not going to give up. So we're going to keep going until we make it out of here. So that was a spark of hope for me. And eventually I built a relationship with God that, you know, strengthened that hope for me.
It's interesting that you felt like you had that religious upbringing, then you lost it, and then it felt like you gained it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much of that support for that hope came from inside the prison? Were there people there who supported you, who believed you?
Yeah, it was a few people who believed me. It's one of those unbelievable situations where it's hard to fathom the idea of someone being wrongfully convicted for something he didn't do. But I had a few people with support system who believed in me. But it was difficult trying to get that belief outside of that system, because outside of that place, no one believed me at all. So it was kind of difficult.
Yeah, I have to think that, people say everyone in prison says they're innocent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you get? Do you think other prisoners actually believed you were?
A lot of people thought I was the same person who screamed the innocent, I mean, innocent, everyone's innocent in prison.
Yeah.
You know, that's the general census, because no one likes to take responsibility for what they do. So when an innocent person walks through the doors of the place like that, everybody automatically assumes that, okay, you're innocent, right? You're innocent. Everyone here is innocent. So when you say something like that, it's not really perceived well. It's not taken well at all.
Yeah. Did you get some pushback? Were people did you suffer some consequences because you kept insisting on your innocence?
Not really consequences. It's just certain guards or certain administration would they didn't like hearing that, because they feel like that was just me not taking responsibility for my actions.
Yeah.
So if I'm there, to them, I'm convicted murderer, regardless if I'm innocent or not. And they say they're not there to determine whether or not I'm innocent. They're there to make sure, or to confine me, to make sure that I'm not a threat to the facility and the safety of the facility. So it was never a moment where they thought, well, maybe perhaps he is innocent, let me help him out. It was just, well, you convicted felon, so this is what your life is.
Yeah. This may seem like a dumb question, but how did you spend your days? How did you pass that time for 23 years?
Initially, it was rough. I spent it alone, my cell. I didn't sleep a lot. But over the years, gradually, I started to build a relationship with God, and I started to see clear, and I had hope. So I started educating myself. I did a lot of exercising. I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of studying.
What'd you read?
I read everything: Western philosophy, Eastern philosophy, theology, psychology, sociology. I mean, I had time to study, so I just studied all kind of things.
I guess that is the one thing you did have, is time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is some part of you still, is there any anger left about this for you? It's easy to say I'm not angry, I was filled with hope, but is there some anger in there somewhere?
Nah, it was. I mean, the anger kind of dissipated, because the anger was only hurting me. So the moment I became cognizant of it, I understood that this anger is not good for me. It don't benefit me. So I wanted to take care of myself, because I knew that one day I see freedom. So I wanted to take care of myself best as I could. And one way of that was getting rid of all the anger and hate I had in me, and forgave everybody who had a hand in making sure that I would never see daylight again.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you have questions for Lamont McIntyre and his mom, Rosie, or for the attorney who helped end this case in such a positive way, give us a call here at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We'd love to have you in the conversation. Rosie McIntyre, you were suffering at the same time, not in prison, but did it feel a little like you were in a prison of your own out here?
Yes, I actually did the time with my son, each and every day.
Yeah. What does that mean? What? How did that not feel like you were free?
It felt like I wasn't free because there was no justice. The day of the crime, I took my son to see what the authorities want, and they said give him 15 minutes and I could come get my son. So from that day on, 15 minutes did not come. So I relived that each and every day of my life.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I've read that is really moving about this case is that you actually, you had a relationship with the mother of one of the victims, right?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that.
Well, from day one, I met, you know, all of the victims' family, and they always wanted to help free my son.
They believed he was innocent, right?
They knew from day one he wasn't the person, so they were very helpful. They wanted to help. The mother wanted to get attorneys, which he already had an attorney, but from that point on, she just worked very hard to try to free my son.
I read that she wouldn't visit her own son's grave as long as you continued to have a son in prison.
That's right. Wonderful, wonderful woman. As two mothers on opposite side, we came together, and it was beautiful, and we worked together to free my son.
Were you as hopeful as Lamont has said he was during those years in prison? Did you ever lose hope?
I didn't lose hope. I lost my nerves. I don't know how to really describe it. It was so much hurting. It was hurt. It was pain. I was doing so much to try to free my own son till I broke several times, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But you came back from it.
Oh, I came back fighting harder.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate both of you sharing such a painful part of your lives in such detail. And I want to turn to you, Cheryl, to kind of talk a little bit about what was happening on the legal side during this time. 23 years is a long time. And I think a lot of people have this idea that the legal system is set up in a way that if a mistake is made, if someone is convicted who shouldn't have been, that there's appeals and there's processes that allow for that to be corrected. Why didn't that happen here, at least not for 23 years?
There were some efforts early on to prove Lamont's innocence. Unfortunately, those efforts to get him relief were denied, and I know that was extremely painful for the family. It's true, Rosie McIntyre never quit fighting for her son, and she kept turning to, you know, whatever direction she could find to look for help. After those early efforts, which ended in approximately 97, 98, there was a period of time where I believe Rosie was writing to people that she thought could bring public attention to what had happened to her son. And she also reached out to Centurion Ministries. And because Centurion Ministries, which is an innocence project, in fact, the first innocence project, I believe, because they get so many requests, it takes a while to sift through them, make a determination, and ultimately that happened. I began working with Centurion Ministries on the case in 2009. I will be very frank in saying that the hurdles that must be overcome to get an old case back into court and to prove innocence are extremely substantial, and you cannot make the mistake of putting together a case that is anything less than you can put together with all of the effort, all of the resources that you can find. You have to track down absolutely every fact in support of your client's innocence. That's what we did. We got some amazing evidence, and here we are.
And was that the turning point? Was there something that happened just this year that made it all come together?
You know, there were many, many things that happened in the last two or three years. We really got some wonderful evidence from one of the eyewitnesses who was extremely frank in coming forward about how she had been pressured and how she had tried to tell authorities that Lamont was not the shooter. We had other people come forward with other evidence that was also very, very important to the case. We did a lot of investigating how the case was done. We even had some folks from law enforcement come forward with some really important information. One was a retired detective from the KCK Police Department who examined every aspect of the case and, you know, said the investigation was filled with inexplicable failures and lapses and deviations from the normal way that investigations were done.
Yeah.
So we felt like by the time we got to court, we had a really, really solid case.
Lamont, you were trying to jump in there a little while ago.
No.
Okay. How closely connected were you with this legal case that Cheryl is talking about? Were they mostly working on the outside, or were you in on all the strategy and all the things they were trying to put together?
Nah. The only thing Cheryl or Centurion Ministries or anyone who's out there working on my behalf wanted me to do was just remain cool, remain calm, and stay out of trouble. So they just asked me to... Well, they don't want to worry about me. So they wanted to be able to focus on the task at hand, just the legal part. And they wanted to know emotionally that I was all right. So they just wanted me to maintain my mental health and that's it.
I should also add here that the Midwest Innocence Project, which has a very strong connection with UMKC, was very involved in the later years of the case. And in fact, my co-counsel are part of that. One is Tricia Bushnell with the Midwest Innocence Project.
Who's been here on the program before.
Right. And then a clinical faculty member from the law school, Lindsay Runnels.
Great. That's Cheryl Pilot. She was attorney, one of the attorneys, working on what became the exoneration of Lamont McIntyre. He's here with us with his mother, Rosie McIntyre. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll get to some of your calls with questions for the McIntyres. If you have a question, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll talk about how the McIntyres have spent this past week, Lamont's first week of freedom as an adult. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we walked through some Shostakovich with Frank Byrne of the Kansas City Symphony. We also learned about Ernest Hemingway's Short Time Here, reporting for The Star. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Join us again on Monday. Steve Kraske will speak with famous biographer Walter Isaacson about Leonardo da Vinci, and we'll compare protest and dissent in the 60s with today's political unrest. Today, we're talking about the newly free Lamont McIntyre. His mother, Rosie McIntyre, is here too, and his attorney, Cheryl Pilot. We're talking about his exoneration after 23 years in prison for a double murder he didn't commit. And we're talking about it with you too. Call us at 816-235-2888 with your questions. And that's what Kent has done from Overland Park. Kent, thanks for being on Up to Date.
I robbed banks all over the country. I was guilty, but when I was incarcerated, I watched so many people walk around saying, I didn't do it, I'm innocent. And they had to live in an environment that was extremely violent. No one believed them. And I can tell you tale after tale of people who finally were able to overcome the justice system and get the evidence they needed to get themselves out of prison. And I'm glad to know that this gentleman was able to do it. But the help is so, there's hardly anyone out there that wants to help you do this. And I just say, I think Mrs. McIntyre is going to have a really good Mother's Day.
I'm sure that's right. Kent, thank you so much for the call. I mean, to Kent's point, Lamont, did you feel like you had enough people helping you, or were there moments of real loneliness not feeling like you had that?
There was a lot of moments of loneliness. It's like you're in the world by yourself in that place because, you know, you're going through something that you feel like no one else can relate to or understand you with. So it's like something you got to carry yourself. But on the outside, I had my family love and support, but it didn't feel that way when I was there because I was felt so far away.
Yeah. Let's take another call at 816-235-2888. This is from Daryl, who's calling today from St. Louis. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, good morning.
How are you?
I'm good.
Tell us, have you had a chance to speak to Lamont McIntyre before this?
Well, yes, I have. Good morning, Lamont.
Good morning. How you doing, Daryl?
Daryl, what? I happen to know Daryl, everyone. So Daryl, tell us why you're calling in today.
Well, I'm calling, of course, to congratulate Lamont and lift him up, and Cheryl and Centurion and also Rosalie, and just to say that be encouraged and give God the glory.
You have a pretty personal understanding of this story, don't you?
Well, yes, absolutely. You know, all of us, we're all connected. You know, Cheryl, see, same law you helped get me out, as well as with Centurion and a bunch of other folks. And so she's been doing this work. She's a fighter, you know, and I'm glad she fought, and a lot of us fought, you know, in regards to try to get Lamont out. You know, so it's just these kinds of injustices that happen for us too often. There's too many people that are still in that place who are just like Lamont and I. So, I mean, we have to continue to fight to get other folks out. And then going forward, you know, I mean, now that he's out, it's trying to just readjust and reacclimate him to society. Because society, I mean, after the lights and the cameras and after you guys, the reporters and everybody leave, you got to live. You got to try to take care of family, got to take care of self. It's, And this is also a difficult challenge. So, you know, that's the next half of his journey.
Well, Daryl, I appreciate you you calling in with those words of encouragement. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Cheryl, you represented Daryl. He said he was exonerated after 20-some years in prison too, right?
24 years.
Yeah. And what can you give us quickly the outline of what happened there? Similar situation, just convicted with not without much evidence?
It was another case that on its surface was extremely lacking in evidence. Again, no physical evidence, no motive evidence, just two eyewitnesses. Whose testimony was not only questionable, but when you started digging beneath the surface, it was obvious that they were manipulated or coerced. So, you know, it really shows how vulnerable the justice system is to coercion and manipulation and other actions that are not consistent with mm-hmm. what we think of as justice. Mm-hmm. It's the system, in theory, is good, but it is vulnerable to being abused and misused. And I have seen things in both of these cases that have been extremely troubling to me.
Lamont, it was just a week ago today that you walked out of the prison. How have you spent the last week?
Trying to force myself to believe it's real. That's what I spend my life doing. I mean, it's a surreal, it's a real moment. I mean, I haven't slept great. I've been eating everything I can. I've been enjoying being out, being free. You know, being able to choose to go or come as I like. It's been good.
I've read that you spent the first night with the woman you married while you were in prison. How did that come about? A lot of people didn't realize that had happened.
Yeah, because that's called a personal life. It's like, you know, that's like, yeah, it's just somebody that was with me, for a long time, you know, when I was, going through the worst moments of my life, and she saw fit to care about me and love me during my most difficult moments. So I just felt like I wanted to spend time with her and be with her, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious what you've noticed in the time that you've been out that is different than you remember 23 years ago when you went into prison. I mean, are there certain experiences or sights and sounds that you never noticed before, but now you notice them because you're free?
Yeah, I notice people don't pay attention no more. Everyone's occupied with something. Everybody's walking with their heads down and people running over you in the traffic. Traffic is scary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like no one's paying attention anymore. So that's kind of weird because everybody's so focused on doing what they was doing. Now everybody got a device in their hand. So that's kind of weird to get used to.
Yeah, I think that would be really weird to get used to. In fact, we have a question about that from Paula in Merriam. Paula, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, you kind of asked my question. So I think I'll just congratulate Lamont and his mother and... you know, wish him a lot of healing and happiness and finding a way to have a normal life.
Appreciate that.
Thanks for calling in, Paula. Appreciate that. You mentioned sort of the devices in everyone's hand. That's new in the last 23 years. You also missed a lot of news, a lot of changes in culture and society. At least you may not have missed them, but you were in prison during them. So 9/11, the entire presidency of George W. Bush, entire presidency of Barack Obama. How closely were you able to follow and keep track of what was happening in the world?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have outside help, connections. So I spent most of my time on the phone. Mm-hmm. So I stayed out, mentally I stayed out of prison as much as I could. So I did a lot of, I was up on current events and stuff like that. I'm pretty advanced in that because I wanted to know what was going on outside of that place. I wasn't really interested in what was going on inside. So I kind of stayed active with that.
How about life experiences? I mean, you spent your whole 20s and 30s in there. What do you feel like you missed out on? And are there parts of that that you want to be able to kind of get back?
Not being able to have kids or, Like my siblings was all younger when I left, and now everyone have kids and family. That's kind of like something I feel like I missed out on, because and I don't feel like I'm older. I feel like I'm younger. I still feel young. I don't feel like I had a 41-year-old life or the kind of experiences a 41-year-old man would have. So I feel kind of, I still feel youthful. I still feel young. I don't feel like I had a full 41-year-old life.
Yeah. Is there something in particular you hope to do that you haven't done that most people your age would have done by now?
Own my own home, be established, you know, pay my own bills, just typical stuff a 40-year-old person would probably experience in his late 20s, early 30s.
Well, you mentioned the owning a home and the paying of bills, and that makes me think about this question that Jack from Shawnee is waiting to ask. Jack, welcome to Up to Date.
Good morning. Congratulations, Lamont.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm just, you know, it seems to me as a citizen of Kansas, you're not been made whole yet. You deserve compensation. I understand that Kansas does not provide for compensation to you, and I'd like to know what you think about that. I'd like to know as a Kansan what I can do to help get you compensated. It seems to me you should be paid a good deal of money for all the years that you've lost. I can't imagine something worse than that. Thank you.
Jack, thanks so much for your call. And Lamont, I'm sure that you've been hearing that a fair amount this week. In a lot of states, a person who's wrongfully convicted will get $40,000 or $50,000, or in Texas, $80,000 a year of compensation for the time they spend behind bars. And Kansas is one of 18 states where that amount is zero. How do you respond to Jack? How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel because of that there's no compensation law in this particular state. The people that's responsible for making sure a wrongful conviction happened is never held accountable. I mean, something has to be done so people can understand and be aware of the fact that they have a job to do, and if it's not done right, there has to be consequences, and people have to be held accountable for what they do. But without compensation laws, that's impossible.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. If you have questions for Lamont McIntyre or his mom, Rosie, or his lawyer, Cheryl Pilot, they're joining us today on KCUR's Up to Date. Paul from Kansas City is with us. Hello, Paul.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My main thing, and he just touched on this, but my question was, you know, more and more we're hearing about these sorts of cases of people who, you know, wrongful imprisonment, and very frequently it seems to me that it's a result of malfeasance on the part of prosecution and law enforcement, and I never hear of any consequences or any repercussions from, you know, when they are clearly violating people's civil rights and are just frequently, I think, just, you know, they're trying to close a case and they don't care, or they are not that as nearly as interested as they need to be in justice as much as they are in just getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
And have there been any consequences to the people who are responsible for this?
Good question, Paul. Really appreciate your calling in. Cheryl Pilot, are there consequences for either prosecutors or police detectives or others who might be involved in what turns out to be a wrongful conviction?
You know, just speaking generally about that at this point, since we are still simply enjoying Lamont's release this week and have not really turned our attention to those questions with respect to this case. But there are mechanisms for accountability. I can't say that what's available necessarily has delivered accountability or justice in other cases. But there are mechanisms. Complaints can be filed against prosecutors with bar associations. That has happened in some instances, and in rare instances, the prosecutor has been disciplined. There's also the ability to file a civil rights lawsuit, and that has happened in a number of cases. These lawsuits are difficult to win. There are lots of immunities that law enforcement officers have, and certainly the prosecutors have. But in some instances, those lawsuits have been successful. So there are some mechanisms, but in fact, our system leans against providing those things. In other words, the doctrines, legal doctrines, are not especially favorable for getting justice for those who've been wronged, like Lamont.
Yeah. So what that means is that not knowing exactly what the future holds in terms of civil recourse, Lamont, here you are, you're 41, but you don't have a resume outside of prison. What are you doing right now? What are your plans for financial stability?
I plan to get my barber's license because I've always been a barber. And I plan to finish up my education by going to school. And I'm going to follow my passions. I'm going to probably get a job in radio or something, so you might want to give me a call later on.
All right. We'll put you in the hiring pool around here. I actually read that you were thinking about podcasting. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I plan. That's a plan of mine, yeah.
What kind of podcast would you like to have? Have you thought about it?
Yeah, anything's deep thought, something we can really learn from, whether it be a relationship, whether it be community, anything that's helpful, anything that's a food for the soul, anything that's thoughtful, something like that.
Did you listen to podcasts in prison? Was that one of the things you had access to?
Nah.
Okay.
I never had a podcast. I never heard of it.
Podcasts have come along during the last 23 years, so this is a new discovery for you.
Exactly. I like the direction it goes in. I like the freedom you have when you in that position. So I think it's something that might suit me.
Well, my friend, you have a lot of podcasts to choose from in the next little while to catch up. Rosie, how have you spent the last week since your son was freed from prison? I have to think it's been pretty overwhelming.
Yes, it has. No more shackles for one.
Yeah.
I mean,
when you see him, his hands are free.
He's free.
What have you, was there a dinner you were waiting to have, a particular kind of family gathering that you'd long been planning?
Yes, but that hasn't happened yet, but.
What's the plan?
To fix his favorite foods, and we had dinner yesterday, so I prepared us, but it wasn't my dinner, so he didn't enjoy it.
Rosie, what do you want to make him?
His favorite is sweet potato pie. That's mm-hmm. That's what he's always wanted, for real. He's like mostly sweets back then, but he wants the sweet potato pie. He wants the banana pudding, but we had those yesterday, but it wasn't Mother's, but he enjoyed it.
So, you know, it's interesting. When I was preparing for the show, I realized how many stories there have been in the last week, not just in Kansas City media, but all over the country about this. Did that surprise you, Rosie, to see that how much attention this case has had?
Yes, it did.
Did you get calls from all these far-flung places?
Some people, I mean, Texas, they were texting me and calling me, and that was wonderful, because after having nobody help, to everybody help, was a great deal.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you? Have you been surprised at all the attention this has gotten, Lamont?
Absolutely. I mean, I hear from people in Germany and Switzerland. I get texts from people. I can't even read the text because it's in a language I don't speak. So it's pretty good to notice that it's been lights being shed on a dark situation, and people are speaking on their outrage because a justice happened. Something happened that shouldn't never happen. So to see the community come together, even if it's not my community, it's another community to come together and speak out on it, it's a great thing.
Yeah. Let's take another question at 816-235-2888 from Ron in Kansas City, Missouri. Hello, Ron.
Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to ask the family and the representatives just a question, an inquiry that came to my mind listening to it. What do you think would be the best way to prevent this from happening in the future? How should we equip ourselves as civilization? Should we educate those who do the investigations, who handle the paperwork? Or should we just get a bigger workforce so that they can – what takes it so long for this to kind of process and to go review these type of things and make a decision that's going to be just?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Ron. I mean, what can we do to address this? Even if we all agree this is obviously was a terrible injustice, what's to prevent it from happening again? What actually, practically speaking, can you do, Lamont, and can other people do?
Well, I think you can't teach integrity, so I think this is an individual act. Like, the police department as a whole is not a bad institution. It's just if you're hiring people who's not of a more a standing or not strong in who they are morally, I think you're going to always run across this problem because people's personal agendas are getting in the way versus actually getting a job done. And I think it's about the job and not people's personal agenda.
Yeah. What do you think, Cheryl?
You know, there are so many different avenues to address this, but, you know, each one provides sort of only a partial answer. I think some of it certainly lies with jurors and looking carefully and skeptically, perhaps, at all evidence and making sure that, you know, when you're deliberating in the jury room as a juror, that you are giving very, very careful thought to what has been presented to you, and that you deliberate fully with the other jurors. And you know, the other things involve perhaps some development in legal doctrines that may happen over a period of time that will allow greater accountability for police and prosecutors. Because right now, it's really tough in many situations to get that kind of accountability.
But you're saying that that's legal doctrines over time. That's like new laws, not mm-hmm. just better character on the part of the leaders.
Well, I think that, you know, Lamont certainly pointed out something that's very, very important. I think there needs to be careful scrutiny of who police departments hire. There needs to be careful supervision of detectives and others who have a great deal of control over the directions that investigations go. There are all kinds of problems that involve things other than intentional misconduct as well, such as implicit bias. I also believe that, frankly, there is a great deal of racism in the system and bias as well against poor people who often don't have the same access to legal representation that people with means do. You know, these are not questions that are simply answered. If you want to have me back for an hour-long show, I'm happy to weigh in. That's all I can say, really. These are difficult questions.
We will take note of that, by the way. We had a tweet from Mindy. She wrote, "As an attorney, it is clear to me that justice is not blind, not fair. Imperfect humans working in an imperfect system, we must do better." We have a call from Maureen. Maureen, thanks for calling up today.
Hi. I also feel jurors should have a responsibility, and something's wrong there that I consistently see. And I think you answered my second question that I'm on. Did you have a public defender?
Appreciate that, Maureen. Thank you so much for calling. She asked about the accountability that jurors face and how challenging that would be to accomplish. And she asked about whether you started with a public defender, Lamont.
Yeah, I did. I'm sorry. Yeah, I did. yeah, he's a public defender. I don't know at the time he was on his way as being disbarred. So it was a horrible situation with a person that didn't really take interest into me or the case at hand. I don't think he was a professional. I don't think he was really serious about what he was doing. And that's a part of the problem, too, with the justice system, because they keep they put people in your life in that particular situation that's not really prepared or equipped to deal with that kind of a case. And they still take on the cases, and that causes a bigger problem than and they're not.
Yeah. There are really rampant problems with representation of indigent persons, people who don't have means. Attorneys are appointed often they lack the training or the background or the time necessary to do the job. They're saddled with too large a caseload.
Which we heard about at the beginning of the show on the Missouri side.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, Missouri has one of the most underfunded public defender systems in the country. And so when we don't provide properly trained, adequately funded counsel to defend indigent persons, this is what we end up with. And it's horrifying.
Let's take one more call. We only have a minute, but Casey from Kansas City is with us. Hello, Casey.
Hi. Hi, Lamont. I just wanted to say thanks for staying strong through your whole ordeal. Can't even imagine. Do you have any advice to others that are in that situation that are waiting to find out if they are going to be exonerated or not?
Great question. Thanks, Casey.
Yeah, that was a good question. I mean, my advice to anybody to find themselves in that situation is never lose hope and always understand and know that it's something greater than yourself. Like, if you get weak in that situation, for me, I relied on God. I think God is a great source of strength and guidance, and I think it'll bring you enough peace of mind to settle yourself to find the right kind of help you need. So I think being spiritual-minded and settled in yourself and God-minded will get you through any kind of situation.
Rosie, any advice for the moms out there of people who've been wrongly convicted?
Never give up. That's my advice.
That's Rosie McIntyre. She's the mom of Lamont McIntyre, a free man for a week after 23 years in prison. He joined us. They both joined us, along with Cheryl Pilot, one of the attorneys on the case. I want to say thank you to all of you for taking time to be with us at such a sensitive and emotional week. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
It was really good to have you here. Our podcasts and our previous programs are at kcur.org/uptodate. You can listen to today's show there later today. Find us on Twitter at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Join us again Monday on the program. Steve Kraske will be back. He'll talk to biographer Walter Isaacson and help us get to know one of the most elusive men of the Renaissance, Leonardo da Vinci. We'll also compare and contrast dissent in the 60s with today's political unrest. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.